You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right. With hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In January 2012, having covered a Somali pirate trial in Hamburg for Der Spiegel, journalist Michael Scott Moore traveled to the Horn of Africa to write about piracy and ways to end it. In a terrible twist of fate, Moore himself was kidnapped and subsequently held captive by Somali pirates. Subjected to conditions that break even the strongest spirits, physical injury, starvation, isolation, and terror, Moore's survival was a testament to his indomitable strength of mind. In September 2014, after 977 days, he walked free when his ransom was put together with the help of several U.S. and German institutions, friends, colleagues, and his strong-willed mother. Yet Moore's struggle is only part of the story. In his new book, The Desert and the Sea, 977 Days Captive on the Somali Pirate Coast, Moore offers an intimate and otherwise inaccessible view of life as we cannot fathom it, brilliantly weaving in his own experience as a hostage with the social, economic, religious, and political factors creating it. And today, Michael Scott Moore comes on the podcast to talk about his incredible tale of survival. He reveals why he believes he was deliberately targeted for kidnapping, how pirates used the media to drive up their ransom demands, and why his own mother had to act as his hostage negotiator. Michael says the Somali pirates are shockingly naive about America, so much so that his captors actually thought his mom had a direct line to the president and access to astronomical amounts of money. And even the man known as the Pirate King had no clue about America's firm policy against negotiating with terrorists. He shares how one of his guards tried to rationalize being a Muslim and a pirate, discusses their uncomfortable relationship with the terror group Al-Shabaab, and contends that the supposed ideological motives for Somali piracy are total BS. He says it's all about cold hard cash, and he talks about visiting one major Somali city whose entire economy is built on piracy. He discusses his one daring attempt at escape and what went wrong, why he didn't even believe it when he was finally released after almost 3 years, and the strange fate that befell his pirate captors after he left. Coming up with Michael Scott Moore in just a moment. Michael Scott Moore is the author of 3 books and a journalist who has written about politics, literature, and travel for The Atlantic, Der Spiegel, Pacific Standard, Bloomberg Businessweek, and the LA Review of Books. In 2012, while researching a book about a group of Somali pirates who were standing trial in Germany, He was kidnapped by Somali pirates and held for ransom for nearly 3 years. He writes about it in a compelling new memoir titled The Desert in the Sea, 977 Days Captive on the Somali Pirate Coast. Michael, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, what a story. I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, Somalia is not exactly at the top of everyone's bucket list. So how exactly did you end up there to begin with?
Well, it took a while. I slowly got interested in Somali piracy, of course, when it started, because I was reporting on it at Spiegel Online in Berlin, where I was living. And then a trial of 10 Somali pirates started in Hamburg in about 2011, actually late 2010. And I followed it for Spiegel Online, and I became very interested, not just in the 10 Somalis who were before the court in Germany, which was the first pirate trial in 400 years in Germany, but also in the reasons why modern piracy had suddenly sort of broken out, where we'd have had more than 200 years of relative peace on the water. Piracy's never been off the planet, but we had a couple of centuries of pretty smooth sailing for merchant vessels, and it turns out that was pretty deliberate. So I thought it would be very interesting to go down to Somalia and research the background of these guys' stories in Hamburg, and also somehow put Somali piracy into historical perspective and compare Somali pirates to other pirates in history. So I had a totally different idea for the book, which for sure. Getting kidnapped actually derailed.
So you flew down to Somalia to do some research for this book, and you went to this lawless area of Somalia called, I hope I have this right, Galmudug?
That's right, Galmudug.
Galmudug.
Galmudug, normally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you met with the president of that region. You saw firsthand how pretty much an entire local economy was built on piracy, right?
That and other things. But what was interesting about that town, Galkayo, which is the capital of Galmudug, is that it was booming kind of in tandem with the rise of pirate ransoms from about 2005, 2007, when things really kicked off the coast. And the interesting thing about Galkayo is that it's more than 100 miles from the Somali coastline. So it's not what most people thought of as a pirate town.
Yeah,
it was more of a pirate resupply town, kind of a place where pirates could retreat to and build their mansions, or so-called mansions, and that sort of thing. So that town was interesting for reasons that weren't real clear to the first most immediate observer.
So it's this landlocked town, but it has all of these, I guess, kind of cottage industries that have sprung up piggybacking on Somali piracy. Huh?
That's right. All of a sudden, within the last, I was there in 2012, within the last 5 or 7 years, it had money transfer centers, extremely modern ones, good cell phone networks, and as a consequence of all that booming economy, also some schools and some more infrastructure that it had had before. It's a city of 100,000 people. It's quite large, but it's in the middle of the desert. It's really remote, except as a crossroads town in Somalia, which is one reason it became important for pirates.
And I mentioned that you met with the president of that region. Does he just kind of turn a blind eye to piracy? I mean, what is the official policy on this?
That's how it seemed at the time. Yeah, he probably couldn't have been in that position unless he had somehow made an accommodation with the gangs that committed piracy. But they were out, as he admitted to me, they were out in a lawless region of Galmudug. So in other words, around Galkayo, the regional government, his government had some power. But outside a certain distance from the capital, it was really criminal gangs that had sway. Mm-hmm. So he admitted that to me, and who knows how much he actually had to do with those gangs or had to deal with those gangs.
At a certain point, you've pretty much wrapped up your assignment there and you're ready to head home, and then suddenly things go sideways. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the day you were kidnapped.
Well, I was traveling the whole time with another journalist. So Ashwin Raman is a very good TV journalist from India who works for German TV. Ashwin went to Mogadishu a bit early. We were originally planning to fly in and out together, but he needed to do some research in Mogadishu, so we went with him to the airport. And we saw him off. He got on a plane, and it was on the way back from the airport that a battle wagon, a sort of flatbed truck with a cannon, it's called a technical in Somalia, was waiting for us. There were about, 10 to 15 gunmen in the back. And when they saw our car, they backed up the technical and pointed the cannon right through our windshield. So that overwhelmed my guards, my guard and my driver. And the men with Kalashnikovs came over to my side of the car and pulled me out.
Wow.
It took me a minute, but I knew it was happening once they opened the door. And I tried to keep the door closed with my arm, and they pounded on my wrist with their guns to get me to release the door. So wow. They broke my wrist. They pounded my scalp, bloodied my head, and then bundled me into a car.
So where did they take you immediately after that?
They took me out into the bush for about 3 hours. We wound up at a bush camp. It seemed fairly random, but actually there was a mattress on the ground waiting for me, which means the whole thing was carefully planned. And at that camp, which was sort of set along the side of a dry riverbed, a little cliff, there were other hostages. And by then I didn't have my glasses. So they had broken my glasses when they captured me. And for the next 2 years and 8 months, I actually couldn't see very well.
Yeah, from what I read in the book, it sounds like you're pretty much like I am without my contacts. You're close to legally blind,
I'm nearsighted.
I guess. Without, yeah,
yep.
Yeah. So I can't imagine what that would be like.
That was the worst. That was the worst realization of that day.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from getting beat up, realizing I was going to have to spend this ordeal half blind was horrible.
Yeah, and you mentioned that this was carefully planned. In fact, I think at some point you said it was pre-planned and researched, and you had actually been specifically targeted, right?
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't just a random kidnapping on the side of the road.
No, I think they set up this this ambush fairly carefully to get me and also to get Ashwin. So I think they wanted Ashwin too. It was just his luck that we took a different route to the airport in the morning. And so we missed where the technical had been waiting for us on the way out. It had probably been there all morning.
Wow.
So he felt quite lucky. And actually the pirates asked me about Ashwin now and then. You know, weren't you with another journalist? So they were wondering what happened to him.
I mean, up till then, had you sort of assumed that there was some kind of an unwritten rule that journalists were off limits for kidnappings?
No, I didn't assume that. I knew that outsiders were going to be at risk, but... I thought that we had the protection of a certain clan in that part of town, that part of the country. South Galkayo is different from North Galkayo, and in the south, a certain clan sort of has dominance. And the elder that we met in Germany and who took us down there and took responsibility for our security was a respected member of that clan.
Okay.
I think probably not as well respected as we thought.
Okay.
In the end, so I think it was members of his clan that turned on us, and you know I was researching one pirate gang, but that was the gang that was involved in the case in Hamburg was a gang from the north, and it was pirates from the south who were supposed to be protecting me, who turned on us.
I'm assuming you didn't have any kind of kidnap insurance, right?
I didn't.
Yeah.
And that was a real problem. I should have just called off the trip when I failed to get it. By then, so much planning had gone into the trip. And frankly, a lot of people don't have kidnap insurance when they go into situations like that. So I decided to go. And that was a big red line that I crossed for myself, you know.
Wow.
That sort of insurance exists, but it's never a sure bet that somebody has it.
Usually it's these large shipping companies that go and spring for that, right?
Yeah, also big media companies. So an independent journalist, it's a little bit more difficult to get something like that.
They had you reach out to your mother, who became sort of your de facto hostage negotiator on the other side. How much did they ask for your safe return?
The first thing they demanded was $20 million.
Did your mom have $20 million?
No, she was just flabbergasted when she heard that. I mean, so was I. I laughed because before they put me on the phone, they said, okay, we're going to force you to demand $20 million. And I must have smirked. because they yelled at me and said, it's not a joke. But it obviously is a joke. You guys aren't serious.
Yeah.
And they weren't serious, but they held on to that fully unreasonable demand for over a year. One reason for that, I think, is that so they made the demand about a week after my capture. 4 days after my capture, SEALs came in and took an American and a European hostage from a different part of Somalia.
Right. One thing that struck me is just for as much as Somali piracy has become a phenomenon over the past decade or two, I would think that pirates would have these negotiations down to a science. But I was surprised to read just how naive they are in so many ways. It sounds like they just imagine every American has a money tree and direct access to the president.
That's how it sounded. Yeah, they gave us messages for Obama as if my mom had a direct line to the White House or something like that.
Wow.
And they really did think that we were just going to sort of explode with money once I was captured.
Yeah.
I think they were as disappointed as anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think that you said in the book that later on when you were interviewed by the FBI, the FBI agents were surprised when you told them that these pirates apparently had no idea that U.S. policy is not to pay any kind of a ransom for hostages.
That's right.
I think that they would have done a little bit of homework.
I would have thought so, too. That's their business. That's their business model involves actually getting a ransom. And the surprise to me was that at least my guards, 18 months into my captivity, were frustrated and angry when they heard that there was going to be no ransom money from Washington. I think they heard that from one of the Somali negotiators. And one of my guards actually came in angry at me about it. And he said, why? Why doesn't America pay? And I tried to tell him the rationale, which is that, well, if we keep paying out for hostages, then more and more hostages will be taken. He'd never heard that before. He'd never heard the U.S. policy, and he'd never heard that rationale, or at least he acted like he hadn't heard the rationale. So that was a really sore sort of lesson that came to me a little more than midway through my ordeal, which is that this stated policy, which all of us know about, especially journalists and people who go into crisis areas, we think that this stated policy of the United States, that we pay no ransom, keeps Americans safe, as if kidnappers out there in the in the field are going to choose who they capture, a European versus an American or something like that, based on stated hostage and ransom policies. It's simply not true.
Yeah, I was interested to read that I guess they really don't discriminate. They take hostages from all over Asia and Africa. Mm-hmm. They're targeting shipping companies from all over the world. It's really not necessarily an ideological war against Western imperialists, per se.
Right. They use that rhetoric to they do like to use that rhetoric because Somalis are poor. And there's a history of colonialism that helps explain that. It's not the full explanation, but they do use that rhetoric, and it works among a lot of the guards. But it's certainly not the only motivation, let's put it that way. The main motivation is obviously money.
Yeah, because I've heard pirates say that they do it because their waters are polluted and all the good fishing has been killed off, so there are no fishing jobs, or it's part of some broader ideological war against the West. Mm-hmm. Does the ideological explanation ring true, or do you think that it's mostly about a financial motivation?
Oh, it's mostly about money.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question. The fishing explanation is important because that illegal fishing really does explain where Somali piracy comes from.
Oh, really?
So in other words, the fact that foreign ships do and did come into Somali waters to take fish is one reason Somalis got into the habit of starting to stop ships and take ships and hold crews for a little while. The thing is, during the 90s, when Somalia first started to fall apart and nobody was defending its coastline, so it no longer had a national navy. There were clan groups that went out and did that for, $50,000 or something. These fishing ships really were coming into Somali waters, and they would hold them for a couple of days and say, you need a license. And the license fee is $50,000. It was a ransom arrangement, but it was low key, and it was simply the price of doing business for a lot of foreign fishing ships. Mm-hmm. But once the Somalis were in the habit of doing that, they started to organize and get ambitious, and by the time the rest of the world heard about what we now call Somali piracy, it was no longer about stopping fishing ships. It was also about getting cargo ships and, it turns out, journalists. So that's a really important part of the book, and actually it's one dimension of the title, The Desert and the Sea, because that conflict between the Somalis who live on the coast and make their living from the sea and the men who live inland and make their living in other ways is really important. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that most of my guards were men from inland rather than from the coast.
Interesting. Do you still see a lot of the same tribalism and warlords that existed in the 90s in Somalia?
Oh, well, that's definitely one cause of the civil war. Mm-hmm. The clans within Somalia don't get along. Somalia is a very interesting place because it's one of the few countries in Africa that's a natural nation state. So everyone who lives within Somali borders is Somali, with some exceptions. There are minorities. But Somalia has not been carved up.
You don't have the ethnic divisions that you have in a Rwanda or somewhere like that.
That's right, or Kenya or something like that. Yeah. The borders are artificial in the sense that some Somalis are outside Somalia, but within Somalia, everyone's Somali, as more or less. But the clans themselves don't get along, and that's why it's in such bad shape. I should add, though, that Somali pirate gangs are similar to pirate groups in history in that members of rival clans can sometimes work together and get along. The gangs are sort of groups unto themselves.
And a couple of times you met with, I guess, the guy who one would call the pirate king or the pirate kingpin, Mohammed Garfangi.
Garfangi, yeah.
Am I saying mm-hmm. that? Yeah. What is this guy like?
Well, he was probably the main financier in my case. He mm-hmm. was probably, there were probably other bosses. There were certainly other bosses, but it's hard to say that he was the top of the heap, but I think financially he was the top of the heap. He met me a few times early to try and shut out any other negotiators and become the main negotiator in my case and get like an embossed letter from President Obama and declaring him innocent of my kidnapping and all kinds of other crazy things. He's actually quite a wealthy guy. He's essentially a warlord in mm-hmm. the sense that any Somali warlord is basically a businessman with armed men.
Mm-hmm. And all of these pirate groups, they operate under him or with his blessing?
Yes, he has an armed, sort of a private army around him. And some of those men work in a pirate gang.
Okay.
He has many business interests. It's not just piracy, but piracy is certainly one of them.
And for such a wealthy man, you say that even he is just completely naive about how things work in the U.S.
Yeah, he acted pretty naive about it. I mean, he wanted this letter, and it actually made some people on the other end of the phone line laugh.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll return with Michael Scott Moore when we come back in just a minute. Did you spend the night tossing and turning? If so, I feel your pain, literally. Chronic back and neck pain have led to many a sleepless night for me, and even worse is that feeling when you wake up all stiff and achy. That's no way to start your day. I talk a lot on this podcast about the importance of getting a full night's sleep. It's vital to your physical, mental, and emotional health, and even your overall longevity. So if you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you've got to try a Purple mattress. Made with a brand new material that was developed by an actual rocket scientist, the Purple mattress will feel different than anything you've experienced. Unlike traditional memory foam, the Purple mattress is both firm and soft, so it's supportive yet comfortable. Plus, it's breathable, so it sleeps cool. That's a big one for me. And with their 100-night risk-free guarantee, if you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund. Not to mention, it's backed by a 10-year warranty with free shipping and returns. You're going to love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great free gifts they're offering site-wide. Just go to purple.com and use my promo code KICK at checkout. That's purple.com, code KICK. Remember, the only way to get this free pillow is to use my code KICK at checkout. purple.com, code KICK. Today's podcast was sponsored by Espresso Monster. That's right, now the guys behind Monster Energy have a delicious espresso drink for when you need an extra burst of energy but don't have time to wait in line at a coffee joint. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of smooth espresso and cream packaged in an 8.4-ounce can. It's just the right size and perfect for when you're on the go. Each can has 3 shots of espresso blended with European milk just the way the Italians do. At 150 to 160 milligrams of caffeine per can, it's sure to give you the energy you need to conquer the day. Espresso Monster has 2 delicious flavors to choose from, espresso and cream and vanilla espresso. That one's my favorite. Man, it is tasty. Produced in Denmark and the Netherlands, Espresso Monster is made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend that's complete with taurine and B vitamins. In fact, I had one just before taping this podcast. You know how sluggish you feel around 1 or 2 o'clock after lunch? Me too. And when I'm tired, I can't get anything done. But I had a yummy vanilla espresso monster after lunch, and it gave me just the jolt I needed to power through the rest of my day. Try it for yourself. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, back to the podcast. I hesitate to call the pirates media savvy, but they did understand that the more media attention you get, the more that they can ask in terms of a ransom demand. How did they go about trying to work the media angle of this?
Well, that's certainly what they thought. And so that's one reason my family and the companies I worked for, the magazines I worked for, tried to keep this out of the media as much mm-hmm. as possible. So the case was not reported on while I was there, before and after. You know, the beginning and the end were reported on, but not during. That was on purpose, because the pirates really did think that my ransom would go up if I became famous.
Mm-hmm. So they had you making proof of life videos and so forth.
We made 5 or 6 yeah. different proof of life videos, or recordings, mm-hmm. photographs, that kind of thing. And I think only one of them really got out.
Really,
the others were sort of squelched mm-hmm. By, you know, once a government official found it, I think they found a way to get it off YouTube or whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact that they were squelched really frustrated mm-hmm. my pirate guards, because the first thing they did the next morning after we did a video was listen to the BBC hoping to hear my name. so it's something they were
interesting
hoping for. I'm not sure.
It's interesting because the media does now have this deliberate strategy where they avoid giving too much attention to these kidnappings. At the time, did you know that, or did you start to worry that they had just given up on you?
I didn't know they were doing it with me. Mm. I also listened to the radio, and I just felt probably abandoned. You know, I thought, yeah. well, either negotiations aren't going very well, or you know, somebody's given up. I didn't actually think that my family had given up, but
sure.
I wasn't quite sure what was going on. I knew that this strategy had been used in other cases.
Okay.
I was aware of David Rode, who was held by the Taliban.
Right.
I knew that his case was kept out of the media yeah. for a while. So that was on my mind.
Yeah. 4 days after you were kidnapped, 2 American hostages were actually rescued. Did that give you some hope initially?
Yeah, that was a surprise, because I didn't think the U.S. Did anything very active in Somalia at all after Black Hawk Down. That was more or less true, but when they had to, they mm-hmm. sent in special forces and that sort of thing. But I didn't think there was much chance of a military rescue once I was captured. Then I started to hear this rumor of a rescue, and I thought, gosh, I wonder what happened, and I hope the hostage is still alive. It was a couple of months before I knew the whole story, and it was Jessica Buchanan and Paul Tisted, an American and a European, who were rescued by the SEALs 4 days after my capture. So in other words, someone knew where they were, and somehow mm-hmm. Obama didn't want to tolerate having 2 Americans yeah. in Somalia or something like that. I don't know.
Did you wonder why they never came for you?
Yeah, I was frustrated by that after a while.
I mean, it makes you wonder, how do they decide who do we go after and who do we not?
Well, one level of the story is that Jessica Buchanan was ill. So okay. I think they knew that, okay. and so there was some urgency. Mm-hmm. The other story, I suppose, is that negotiations were going on for me. But for me, the negotiations were frustratingly slow. So
yeah.
I think there were probably plans to come get me, but yeah. I don't know details about that.
Yeah, and you talk about the sense of false hope that you would get when these regular surveillance planes or drones would fly overhead. At a certain point, just out of self-preservation or your own sanity, did you have to convince yourself that no cavalry was going to swoop in and save you?
No. So it was different from that. So I did feel hope whenever I heard a plane overhead.
Yeah.
But I had to be neutral about whether somebody was going to come in and get me, but partly because, you might die. Those raids are incredibly dangerous.
True.
And so there's a good chance the hostage might get killed. And if they don't feel confident that they can do it, you know, with 100% success, then they won't do it either. So I knew that these things were complicated. But I think this sense of hope that, you know, gets awakened by an airplane overhead, or even worse, by a pirate saying you're going to go out in 3 days or 2 weeks or whatever, creates a cycle that was extremely damaging. It was extremely painful. And I had to sort of detach myself from that.
Did you ever get to know your captors and have any kind of a deeper conversation with them beyond that of captor and captive?
Sure. I mean, that was the case with about half the guards.
Mm-hmm.
At least after my stint on the ship, I spent five or six months on a fishing vessel that had been hijacked by the pirates. I got to know this one group of guards that was holding me after the fishing ship pretty well. And about half of them, you know, didn't give a shit about me. And they didn't even answer when I tried to speak Somali to them. The other half, you know, they could meet me halfway. And so they could speak a little bit of English. I could speak a little Somali and we could get along. I wound up asking one of the guards why exactly he thought he could be a pirate and still call himself a Muslim.
Really? What did he say to you?
Well, he was very, I mean, all my guards prayed 5 times a day, and I was shocked by that. And so when I challenged him, at first he was defensive, and finally he said something very surprising. He said, you know, in the Quran, Michael, it says to struggle with the infidel. And because we're not Al-Shabaab, we're not terrorists, we're not going to shoot you for being an infidel. But we do think that it's okay for us to steal your money because you're an infidel. That was a very convenient sort of interpretation of Islam for a pirate. The reason that surprised me is that they were Sufis. And, you know, that's a slightly fundamentalist answer for a Sufi. So I struggled with that for a long time. I had to work that out in the book.
Yeah. What was the relationship like between the pirates and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated terror group Al-Shabaab?
They hated each other.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's actually true. They would have... most of my pirates were militiamen, and they had or they would have fought with Al-Shabaab on, you know, some front of the civil war. Though these guys, because they were most of them clan soldiers, trained by the clan, directed, you know, by their individual clan, and directed normally to defend a certain region, their home region. If Al-Shabaab were to come to their region, those guys would have been on the front line. They couldn't stand Al-Shabaab because Al-Shabaab was strict in ways and had tried to impose Sharia in ways that most Somalis really chafe under.
Right, because I think you said the pirates were addicted to something, I forget what it was, some kind of something they chewed.
Cut.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before.
It's a leafy...
And that would have been forbidden.
Totally forbidden. Smoking cigarettes would have been forbidden. Yeah. Listening to music would have been forbidden. Mm-hmm. And most Somalis like all that stuff, you know, pirates in particular. But a cut addiction is also very detrimental and very expensive. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit like chewing, I don't know, coca leaf or something. Mm-hmm. It gives you a high, and then it depresses you, and you have to sleep, and then you wake up and do it again.
And you had to live in fear of a worse fate, the possibility of being sold to Al-Shabaab. Was that just an idle threat, or were those transactions common between pirates and Al-Shabaab?
They weren't common. I think at first it was an idle threat. Mm-hmm. I think the calculation changed a little bit when Islamic State started to behead Americans in Syria. So I heard about James Foley on the radio when it, you know, a day after he was killed. I happened to have a shortwave radio then, and one of my guards came up to me and said, you know, James Foley. I said, I know, I heard. He said, well, that's not going to happen to you. Huh. But as it happens, from what I hear, among al-Shabaab members who wanted to turn towards IS. Normally they're affiliated with al-Qaeda, but there was a faction that was interested in sort of aligning with IS. My price went up. So they knew that there was an American in Somalia, and conceivably there was a faction of al-Shabaab people who were suddenly willing to pay a little bit more for me. So that was actually, I wasn't aware of those details while I was a hostage, but that was suddenly a risk. And
so if the ransom didn't come through, there was a possibility that these guys would have paid a pretty penny for you.
A possibility.
So it would be a media triumph for them to be able to behead you on television.
Exactly. Then I would have been a political prisoner all of a sudden.
Scary.
Instead of, that's right.
As weeks turned into months and even years, did you ever begin to worry that they would just at some point cut their losses and kill you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's not normally how pirates work, but...
Right, but after two or three years, I mean...
Yeah, I was worried about... it was taking so long, I was worried that... they were just going to sell me to some other group. Mm-hmm. They were going to kill me by accident. So that does happen.
Explain that.
so the ship that I was held on had been hijacked, I think, in March of 2012. Okay. I was captured a couple months earlier. When we finally wound up on board as prisoners, along with the rest of the crew, a month later, the first thing the crew told us was that the captain had been shot dead by pirates. He'd been shot dead by pirates shooting wildly at the bridge. So it was an accident. He wasn't executed by pirates. He was just shot by accident. And that happens.
You have all these pirates sitting around with nothing to do, all hopped up on cot.
Exactly.
I mean, those things probably do happen with Kalashnikovs in their hands.
Not really very difficult.
Yeah.
And the other hostages had also died of disease or, potentially starvation too. Mm-hmm. So there were all kinds of things that could have gone wrong.
Was physical abuse common?
It wasn't systematic.
Okay.
I was certainly beaten a couple of times, but it wasn't systematic. And there was no torture of me. There was torture of another hostage.
You must have plotted a million escape attempts in your head, but only one time did you actually make an attempt. Mm-hmm. Well, why did you decide to go for it that day?
Well, that was the end of my time on the ship. So
the
ship was anchored, like I said, for most of these 5 months off of Hobyo. And one day the anchor chain broke and the ship had been running down. And there was a fear among the crew that we were going to move onto shore anyway. And once the anchor chain broke, I thought, we're definitely going to move ashore. And I didn't want to move ashore. And I also knew for a fact that we were being watched by surveillance planes because I could see them. And in fact, even after the chain broke, a plane turned up within 20 minutes. And I thought, that night, I might just take a chance and jump in case somebody's watching and can come get me in the water. In either case, I thought, the ship, which was not running very well, was just going to keep running because it was moving parallel to the Somali shore. And I'm a surfer. We weren't very far from the shore, so I figured even in the dark I could make it to land. What I didn't count on was that the ship could actually not exactly turn around but come back in my direction.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened.
What was that like? What did they say to you
Everyone on board was angry if they were pirates or sort of shocked if they were other hostages. The other hostages were very kind, you know. I mean, they assumed I was in trouble. I was in less trouble than maybe they thought, but the pirates were really angry.
Yeah. So. I mean, over the course of almost 3 years, how did you pass all that time?
Oh, well. You have to learn to live in your head.
Yeah.
You know? Yoga helped.
Really?
But I couldn't do that all the time. Listening to the radio sometimes and getting my hands on pen and paper so I could write was absolutely essential.
Yeah.
But sometimes all I could do was lie there with my own thoughts, you know. And so I had a couple of books unfinished in Berlin, and so I learned to sort of run through them in my head and revise them in my head. I actually composed whole paragraphs in my head, and then I had something new, not yet written, to memorize and to go through as like a routine every morning.
So incredible.
Eventually I had 2 hours worth of just stuff to rehearse in the morning. And so I would get up and eat my breakfast, and I would lie there and just run through all these words in my head.
Amazing.
It really helped.
Yeah. So you were sitting there editing, you know, other books that you were writing at the time in your mind, and then memorized, like an actor memorizing a script every day.
Yep. And that helped.
Can you recite them to this day?
No, but as soon as I got a pen and paper, I wrote them down. Mm-hmm. Some of them I didn't write down. Some of them I kept in my head until I got out. But then I spilled everything into my computer.
Well, 3 years later, you were finally released when your mom came up with $1.6 million in ransom money. When the pirates told you that you were being released, what did you think? Did you even believe them at first?
No, I didn't believe them. That was raised with my mother and family and some magazines I'd worked for and so on. I did not believe it because everything was so first of all, they wouldn't let me talk to the negotiator on the phone.
Oh, really?
Who was working on the case at the end. So I had about 30 seconds on the phone with him, and he couldn't explain anything. So I assumed something weird was going on, and I just assumed somebody was going to come blasting in with guns at some point, or I was going to get sold to another group. And I didn't believe it until I was halfway to the airport, I think.
What went through your mind when you finally took off from the runway?
I finally appreciated that I was going free when I saw the bush pilot there waiting with a Cessna. And he was very reassuring. And he sort of kept up a patter talking about how he had to bring in all his own fuel from Mogadishu and that sort of thing. But there was a delay on the tarmac. He couldn't get clearance from the so-called tower, which was really the tower was just a Somali somewhere else on the tarmac with a walkie-talkie, you know. But Derek had to get permission from this guy, and he tried to keep us there for a little while, I think because some journalists were going to come and photograph us. And I'm like, get us out of here. And so finally, once we were up in the air, there was an incredible sense of relief.
My God.
And that, by the way, that is not clear in the book. That was not clear to me that there was no tower because Derek used the word tower.
Yeah.
And just until a couple of weeks ago when I saw Derek again in Nairobi, did I realize that it was really just a guy with a walkie-talkie.
Now, looking back, do you ever wonder what became of your captors? Were any of them ever brought to justice?
Well,
have you heard of them?
Yes, I have heard. 2 days after I got out, there was some conflict between two factions of the pirate gang. And they met to talk about dividing up the ransom money, and there was a shootout. And five of those men were killed. Three of them were top bosses, two were sort of semi-top bosses. And a couple guys got away. Or in the case of Mohammed Garfanji, who we mentioned earlier, he wasn't even there. So
that's like a classic ending to any of one of these bank robbery heist kidnapping movies. It's like the Treasure of the Sierra Madre, where they all turn on each other once the money's on the table.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Remarkable.
And I was horrified and shocked and astounded to hear that when I was sort of, getting used to life as a free man in Nairobi. A colleague from Der Spiegel told me about it, actually. I couldn't believe it.
So, wait, you said that you were in Nairobi for a while after that?
Yeah.
I would have gotten as far away from Africa as I possibly could if I'd been you.
Well, it wasn't up to me.
I
was also not in very good shape.
So they
took me to the first safe place, which was Nairobi. And I spent 2 or 3 days there. And that was a nice place to recover. You know, it was very peaceful. I still like Nairobi for reasons I don't quite understand. It's not a pretty city, but it is where I recovered after Somalia. And I think I always liked the direct sunshine there. You know? And I like the people. But I went to Nairobi first, and that's where I first saw one colleague of mine from Der Spiegel, and he's the one who told me about the shootout, and I was just sort of flabbergasted.
Have you given much thought since then to the broader problem of piracy? I mean, right now, the U.S. government, like we talked about, has this policy of not paying any kind of ransom. And I guess it's kind of a crapshoot as to who they come to rescue and who they don't. What do you think would actually put an end to all this?
Well, if you're serious about a policy that will take that market force out of kidnapping and broadcast to groups around the world that capturing an American is dangerous, then you have to consistently rescue. In other words, people have to die. That's difficult because every kidnapping case is different. So it's simply not always possible. And if that were the policy, I think the only country in the world that's had a policy close to that is Israel. Then the people in the country have to tolerate losing more hostages.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure we can do that. And I'm not sure we should. So
okay, interesting. So yeah, so making it more costly for them might alleviate the problem a little
bit. If kidnappers died on a regular basis when they tried to capture Americans, then word would get around. But simple statements from men in suits from behind a State Department podium, that doesn't work.
The U.S. government may decide not to pay ransoms, but can they tell families and companies not to pay a ransom for an American citizen?
They cannot.
Yeah.
There was some confusion.
They can't take the profit motive out of it necessarily.
I mean, a family still has the right to raise it privately. And there was some confusion about that in the Obama White House when James Foley was a hostage. In fact, somebody from I've forgotten his name at the moment, but somebody from the Obama White House actually called up the Foley family and told them that because Foley was in the hands of terrorists and not just criminals, that paying the ransom would have been material support for terrorism. That might be true, but it's not something that the U.S. government normally gets in the way of. And that was that person wound up leaving his job.
Wow.
So that's really not U.S. policy, and it never has been.
Now, in the almost 3 years that you were in captivity, what do you suppose was the biggest lesson that you took from all this?
Oh, gosh. The most interesting thing is that, you know, we like to think that hope is somehow necessary to move forward. Mm-hmm. And if you live without hope, you know, why do you live at all? That's not true. So I had to actually live apart from that cycle of hope and despair, because that cycle was getting to be very psychologically dangerous for me. So detaching myself from that was the most important thing for getting through.
Remarkable. Well, again, the book is called The Desert in the Sea, 977 Days Captive on the Somali Pirate Coast. Michael Scott Moore, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Michael Scott Moore for coming on the podcast. Order his book, The Desert in the Sea, 977 Days Captive on the Somali Pirate Coast, on Amazon or Audible. Visit his website at radiofreemike.net and follow him on Twitter at @MichaelSCTMoore. Today's podcast was brought to you by Espresso Monster. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream. I wouldn't even be recording this podcast right now if I hadn't had a vanilla Espresso Monster after lunch today. It's delicious, and it was just the jolt I needed. Try for yourself, folks. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.